listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
Hello again, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since 5 o'clock. The first half we were with Ken Foster. We're back with Leora Krieger, author of When She Sleeps. Leora is a lawyer and a writer. She works as a referee with a juvenile division of the L.A. Superior Court. She's been profiled in the Los Angeles Times for her innovative use of essay writing in her work with the courts. Her debut novel, First the Raven, was published in 2002. She was a finalist in the Ernest Hemingway Competition, the James Fellowship, and the Faulkner Writing Competition. Krieger lives in Los Angeles with her husband and two children and is here today to talk about her novel, When She Sleeps, published by Toby Press. Hi, Leora.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Talk about this book. I'm always just so curious about the genesis of books, where they come from, where the idea came from, and how it blossomed and grew into a book.
Well, I you know, it sort of takes on its own urban legend after a while, but I always tell people that this book started with a dream, and I think that's really how it began. You know, I've always been sort of interested in the power of dreams and how they affect us during the day, and I've always wondered whether, you know, dreams can be sort of transported to other people, and this sort of little kernel of a thought kept bugging me. And a friend of mine once told me a story about how she'd come to work one day, and she had a dream, and she was telling her coworker about the dream, and the coworker started sort of filling in the pieces for her, and they realized that they basically had the same dream, and this was the most bizarre and oddest feeling that they had, and that just sort of got me thinking. And when I dreamt about this character of mine, this 13-year-old Amerasian girl, I thought to myself, this would be the avenue through dream.
So had you been working on anything at that time? Were you involved in a project, or were you waiting? Were you in the waiting phase of what's going to grab me and take me away with it?
I think I'm always in the waiting phase. You know, there's something's bound to hit me. I think when I try too hard to have, you know, something come at me, that when I'm searching too hard, it doesn't come. So I just sort of let it happen. And there's sometimes I actually have to just put it aside. I call it putting things on the shelf,
mm-hmm.
and just letting go and just sort of having faith that the right time will come. You know, there are times when I can't write. Although once I'm in a project, I write every day, or at least I try to. Even if it's 15 minutes, I must put that 15 minutes in. But when I'm not inside a project, I just sort of wait for it to sort of distill in me somehow.
And then when that happens, how do you know when it's time to write? Is it just you're moved to write and you just begin and you want to be there daily, or how do you do that?
I always sort of start in the middle somewhere. I have never written chapter one as chapter one. Something starts me going, and I write a few pages, and I usually end up realizing that those pages are somewhere in the middle of a book at some point. It's never the beginning and it's never the end, because I never storyboard my novels. They just sort of take me on the journey with them. And that's the excitement for me, that I don't know where I'm going with it. And sometimes it's sort of precarious, because you get, it's very scary. I don't know where I'm going with this, and maybe this is just terrible. But I sort of let it go with the flow and let it come to me. And I find that if I sort of believe in it, it does come to me. It's sort of like that field of dreams thing. You know, if you build it, it will come, you know.
Yeah,
it will come.
Sure. So with this book, then, it began, and did you end up having to do any plotting or outlining, or did you follow it and allow it to be sort of a daily discovery?
What happens is that once I sort of start, as I say, in the middle, and then go out towards the front, towards the beginning and towards the end, at that point, when I have enough chapters going, then I'll sit down with what I have and look at it, and I'll write out, this is chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and I'll see what I have, and then I'll put it in some kind of order for myself and see how the structure is. I like to take the bird's eye view later rather than right at the beginning. Now, I know other writers don't work this way at all, but for me, that's what seems to work, that I take the bird's eye view when I'm deeply into the book, and then I can just sort of, you know, juxtapose them, you know, one chapter next to the other, and see if it works, and see if I'm going in the right direction. I can't manage to do that in the beginning, because it's not there yet. It's not crystallized. It's just sort of amorphous somewhere inside of me, and I just let it happen, and then I take charge of it.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Leora Krieger, author of When She Sleeps, published by Toby Press. Will you read to us?
Oh, I'd love to.
Yes.
I've never read on the telephone before. This will be wonderful. Okay, there's always a first time for something.
That's right.
All right, this is actually chapter 1, and I'm going to read about 2.5 pages here.
Okay.
The night we returned to Saigon, my mother, Lynn, exacted the last promise I would ever make to her, my vow never to call her mother again. We just arrived in the city before dusk, Grandmother Than, Lynn, and I, hiding until twilight, sank the last of the hot sun. Then we emerged with all the others, all the ghosts from the countryside. And like them, we were homeless, carrying our kerosene stoves and torn mats on our back, shadows looking for work and shelter in the city. We found a space on the bottom landing of a cracked stairwell and made our beds there, on the concrete, still splintered with old shrapnel. I was almost asleep when Lynn whispered to me and made me the accomplice in her crime. Every name is its own world. Every word is a journey, Lynn began. Promise me, Mai. Swear it, she said, taking hold of my hands. Give me your word you won't call me mother, only Lynn from now on. I waited for my eyes to adjust to the dark and looked at her closely. Before the takeover, she'd been a lecturer in linguistics at the University of Saigon. She was a teacher of etymology, skilled at exhuming the origins of words, finding their buried secrets. For her, a name was an entire history, a universe, not to be disturbed, never to be erased or forgotten. I hesitated to answer, but she pressed me. My, please. I promise. It was then that I made my own oath. I would let her rob me of this intimacy, but I'd never let her take anything else from me again. Say it now, she demanded, emboldened. Say my name. Yes, Lynn, I said, watching her, then looking away. She was reckless with her own promises, a charlatan. She was stealing the word from me, doing exactly what she professed to despise, making mother extinct, lost to me. But I knew I couldn't do otherwise. I'd seen her eyes find a fleck of light in the black hole of the stairwell when I said her name. I knew Saigon was the place of her fall, her surrender. And now that we'd returned, she needed to have her name said aloud and repeated. I understood then that every time her name was uttered, it gave her strength and reminded her that her spirit existed. It's not called Saigon anymore. They renamed it Ho Chi Minh City, Lynn said, without sadness. I was exhausted from our three-day walk back to the city, and I didn't care that Boulevard Charnière was now the Hugh Street or Dong Khoi. Only Lynn cared about the exchanging of names, the substitution of words, one for another. For me, they were a waste of breath, here in a place where words did not matter. She blamed others for taking away the names, but she was the one who was the thief. Lynn was worse now, 2 years after the tanks had crashed through the presidential palace. Her madness came and went more often. She was a wick, sometimes burnt out, at other times aflame. Often she didn't know where she was or who she was, but she taught me French during the day and English at night. She closed her eyes and repeated the sounds softly like lullabies, told me the names of things, made me pronounce them over and over. Say it again, Mai, don't forget. Yes, Lynn, I said, and I was now a foot soldier in the war of words she waged against herself. I took to English faster than French, maybe because she taught me English in the soft of night as we lay down together in the dark, the gloominess our blanket against the daylight, and English became my language of dream and darkness. Repeat it, Mai, Lynn said, and I liked that my name sounded like the English Mai, that it meant a belonging to something, someone. Then Lynn told me there were no belongings, only longings. Now that you're 13, you're almost a woman, and you need to know. Even that Lynn tried to take away from me, even my belonging.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Leora Krieger reading from When She Sleeps, published by the Toby Press. And you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. What sort of research did you need to do? I know you've lived, you're from Israel, you've lived in Paris, but there's so much more that it just seems like there must have been some research, and when did it come in?
Absolutely. I sort of was a child during the Vietnam War era, and I sort of understood some of it in some vague way. And when I started writing this book, I realized there was so much I didn't know. So I really did a lot of research. I did not go to Vietnam. That's the one place I really wanted to go but couldn't make it to. I read a lot. The two most important things I did, I think, was I read a lot of Vietnamese poetry in translation. I thought that would give me the best feel for the language and the type of sort of cultural pieces that I was missing.
Mm-hmm.
I was very concerned about, although this book is also about the American girl, who is her half-sister, and the Amerasian girl. The Amerasian girl is really, I suppose, the strongest character in the book. And I wanted to be very careful, since I'm not of that culture, to write her as truthfully as I possibly could. So I spoke to a lot of people. I also interviewed a lot of nurses who went to Vietnam and sort of got a feel for what it was like to be in the hospitals there, because the father in this book is a surgeon. So I sort of had to know what was going on in the hospitals in Saigon and in the field. And then after I wrote most of it, I had a few Vietnamese friends of mine read the book and make sure that everything that I was writing sort of rang true to them as well. I wanted to be sure I was sensitive to those issues. But I really felt that, you know, as much as I read and I read about the history, the thing that really sort of brought me into the perspective and into the head of my characters was the poetry.
Interesting. Any in particular?
You know, I wrote this book 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, and it's just the names are escaping me right now.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a special sort of poetry, sort of very steeped in folklore.
Mm.
And the beauty of the country is just unbelievable. I looked through, you know, photography books, and there's a special store that I go to in Burbank called Geographia.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of it. But every time I start a new book and there's some kind of place that I've never been to, I always buy as many maps as I can. And I do sort of like a channeling through maps.
Mm-hmm.
I spread them out on my desk and I sort of walk the streets that my characters would be walking on. And that somehow brings me closer. It's sort of a virtual experience. Run my fingers up the streets on these large scale maps, and I find that helpful.
Now, how do you work in writing? I mean, you're a lawyer. You work with the Los Angeles Superior Court.
Right.
When does the writing happen?
Anytime I can snatch a moment.
Mm-hmm. So you've learned to work with moments.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm scared to death of the possibility. I mean, I've been dreaming for years of just having the luxury of writing full time. And because I've been doing this way for 10 years, I sort of worry that what would happen if I actually did have a whole day to write? How it's just knowing that I only have these snatches, that I only have an hour here, an hour there, the weekend or whatever it is, it forces me to make absolute productive use of that time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no time for dilly-dallying.
Yes.
You know, I have to get to it or else it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a sense a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Self-imposed.
Sure.
But
well, I love hearing that because so often I think writers don't write because they don't have a big block. We wait for that big block of time when we're going to have all day or, you know, a weekend, a week, whatever. Those blocks of time that never really seem to come, and so the writing gets put off.
Right.
And never enough gets done instead of looking at time and saying, well, I have 15 minutes right now. Like you said, I can do it right now.
Right.
I can do 10 minutes later, you know, and learning to work with those pieces.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we all live in a very hectic world. I mean, I work, I have kids, I have a husband, a household, a dog. I have to find the time. I did wait for that block of time for a long time. I had, you know, wanted to be a writer for many years, and since I was working, I was always putting it off. And then it sort of struck me one day that I could be putting this off forever. And I sat myself down and said, you know, if you only write 10 pages, so be it, but write those 10 pages. And I steal time whenever I can. I also take along with me everywhere I go a little notebook or, you know, at times I've used little tape recorders. That doesn't really work for me. I actually like those really old-fashioned English composition books, those black and white marbly things. I drag those around with me everywhere, and those are great because, you know, they're not, they're really cheap, and you can do anything you want with them. I cut out stuff that I like from newspapers, and I just paste it in there, and then I always have somewhere to go if I have an idea that just sort of I know is going to flee very soon, you know, and I just stick it in there and then look at it at some other point. So, and I got little, you know, little notes everywhere. So it doesn't matter, you know, as long as you get it down, as long as you spend the time with it. It doesn't matter if it's in pieces, I think. Well, maybe it does, but that's the only way for me, you know. But I think most people don't have the luxury of, as you said, great blocks of time.
So. Yeah. And sometimes when we do have that, we don't use it. We just find it's just too expansive. And
right.
Where can I find my little piece of, my little cubby of time? It does seem to work better for a lot of writers.
Yeah.
I know it does for me. We have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you real quick about your what it said in your bio about your innovative use of essay writing in your work with the courts. What's that about?
I decided to sort of put the two parts of my life together in court one day. I realized that many of the young people that come before me, I deal mostly in pre-delinquents and people who are sort of on the verge of delinquency, were not able to express themselves very well in court. They'd have a, you know, shoplifting case or a vandalism, and you'd ask them, like, why did you do this? And the answer would be a shrug of the shoulder, and that would be it. And I thought to myself that if I can express myself better in writing, then surely these young people, maybe that would help them express themselves. So very often, when I don't get the answers that I want or I need in terms of making a sentence or a disposition, I ask them to write about themselves or what they're hoping for or what they want to do or why they did what they did, and I find that I get a lot of interesting answers. So that is one way I use essay writing in court. And in another case, I have a friend of mine who is also a writer who wrote a short story about a young man who was killed after a drunk driving accident. And she wrote a little piece in terms of how the mother viewed the accident. And I've asked people to write their response or reaction to the essay as part of their sentencing. And that has also taken people aback. But also, I've had a lot of feedback from the parents who have found that this really sort of made an impact.
And, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to talk to you more about that sometime.
Absolutely.
We're done. We're at the end of our time. I so appreciate you coming on. And
well, thank you.
When
you made the time go by so quickly.
Chatting on the sofa, as I said. This is what this show is. Anyway, continued good luck with When She Sleeps.
Well, thank
and,
you.
Hopefully we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Leora Krieger, again, author of When She Sleeps, published by Toby Press. And you can visit her website at leorakrieger.com. That's LeoraKrieger.com. If you want to know more about the show, go to my website at penonfire.com. There you can email me if you want to be on my weekly email list. And we are podcasting. This show may go up next week at Writers on Writing. Well, where is it? It's right. Well, you know what? Just go to my website and click on the radio tower on the homepage, and it'll take you there. The ASJA conference is coming up the end of April. Go to asja.org. It's a 3-day writing conference in New York City. Actually, 2 days for non-members. Wonderful panels, mostly journalism-related. Great stuff. asja.org. I'm going to leave you now with a quote by Alice Hoffman, who said, "All the characters in my book are imagined, but all I have is a bit of who I am in them, much like the characters in your dreams. All are formed by who you are." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.